Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, October 15th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion about Wes Craven's 1984 movie, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and we'll present an interview with stars Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
And staff writer Bill Bria.
Ho, 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 yeah.
Okay, so this film is now available to own on digital, and as of today, it's also available on 4K. So WB sent me the disc, which has the theatrical cut and an uncut version of the movie. It has multiple commentaries on it, alternate endings, a few featurettes, and stuff like that as well. The transfer looked pretty great to my eye. I know James Cameron recently released a few of his movies on 4K, and there's a big uproar about how bad some of them looked, and I think he was using AI to smooth some elements of the picture out. There's nothing disastrous like that happening here, as far as I could tell. So I want to start with a two-part question for both of you. Do you remember how old you were when you first saw the original Nightmare on Elm Street? And what is your relationship just to this first movie, not the rest of the franchise? So BJ, let's start with you.
Great news. I was probably 8 years old. and the reason is that I was a horror kid growing up and my mom was really big into horror movies, but there was this sort of mythos that surrounded Freddy Krueger because from a very, very young age, my mom always used to say that A Nightmare on Elm Street was the scariest movie she had ever seen because she saw it in theaters and then had to walk home with her friend from the theater in the dark. And apparently it was like a foggy night. So it was very creepy and it has just haunted her forever. So I had seen most of like the big slashers before I saw Nightmare on Elm Street because there was this thing that lingered of, if that is the scariest movie that my mom's ever seen, am I going to be able to handle it? And then I watched the movie as a kid. I'm 90% sure it was on like an AMC Fear Fest, or maybe my mom rented it. I'm not totally sure on those details, but it blew my mind. The practical effects, how huge they are, how over the top everything is compared to a lot of the other slashers, which seem, you know, very intimate in a lot of ways, because I had yet to go into the sequels of a lot of these slashers where kills get more inventive and more wild. Whereas Nightmare on Elm Street came out the gate swinging. It's like we're sucking someone into a bed and shooting him into the ceiling. And it was like, that was nuts. And so I immediately just kind of fell in love with Freddy and especially with Nancy. So it's a lifelong love affair I have with this movie.
Awesome. All right. So Bill, what about you? So how old were you and yeah, your relationship just to this first movie?
Well, I'm already going to break your rule, Ben, because I was an 80s kid, but I grew up in a Freddy world. And there's really no way to divorce that from my experience of coming up to the first movie, because I didn't actually sit down and watch the first movie until probably 18, 19, maybe even a little bit older. It was somewhere around the end of high school, beginning of college. I can't be sure of the exact date, but I know that I came to being a horror movie fan kind of late. And, you know, I have a whole story about watching Evil Dead at a friend's birthday party and thinking it was going to be scared out of my mind and then suffering through it, but actually loving it and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, I remember one of my first memories as a kid was, there was two. One is having my cousin bring up an issue of the Nightmare on Elm Street comic book that Marvel put out. They only put out two issues in 1989. And I remember that cover like it was, you know, yesterday, because it just blew my mind. I was like, what is this thing on this cover? And of course, it was Freddy. I remember an episode of Siskel and Ebert's At the Movies on TV, and my mother and father made me leave the room for their review of Dream Warriors because I could not even be in the room to have them talk about it. So that's how strict my parents were and how worried they were that it was going to influence my young mind. So I never forgot that. And obviously, growing up as I got older and, you know, more mature and just sort of more aware of my surroundings and pop culture and whatnot, I learned, you know, who Freddy Krueger was and what the movies were. But I didn't actually sit down with this first one with a couple of friends until I think somewhere around high school. And yeah, it safe to say it blew my mind. I was so enthralled with the way that, writer-director Wes Craven really built this dream logic world of around this character. And I was already taken, and I hadn't seen any of the sequels at that point yet, so I was already taken with just this first movie about how visually and narratively inventive it was, more than just, oh, this is an interesting way to kill someone, you know, sort of thing. It really engaged my imagination and my, you know, fantasy in my head about, you know, what other things could be done with this character or this world. And that's what got me into the series, of course. And that's what made it, I think, for my money, my favorite slasher series.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, those are strong words there. This was my first time ever seeing this movie.
That is so wild to me because, I mean, we're talking about a 40-year-old movie here. We're going to be spoiling a movie that is older than I am. But the fact that you have somehow missed it after all these years is so exciting to me. Like, what a gift for you.
I know. It really kind of felt that way. So it was a little cheesier than I expected, but there are several ideas that this movie brings up that I just thought were incredibly intriguing. So I wrote down some of the fears that this movie taps into. So I'll run through those real quick. So not being able to sleep and having your dreams be invaded, just a terrifying concept, like all-timer idea for a horror movie. Just really excellent stuff there. Not being believed and not being helped when you really need help. Like, all the adults in this movie and Nancy's life are almost completely useless to her the whole time. And her dopey boyfriend, played by Johnny Depp, just drops the ball twice when she specifically asks him to help her and her life is on the line. I mean, this guy is just like terrible boyfriend material there. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that character before I continue with my list.
But I agree. Glenn.
Yeah, Glenn. I mean, I do think it's really funny. Like, I had to stifle my laughter a little bit where you were like, this idea of not being believed and all the adults are useless. And I just want to like flip my chair around like a cool college professor and go, Ben, I don't know how to tell you this, but that is the story of every teenage girl in a horror movie ever.
Oh, yeah, totally. No, this is not like ideas that this movie originated necessarily. It's just things that could be primally scary, I think.
Oh, yeah,
and
it is.
I think the movie does a really good job of capturing that feeling of like, God, is no one around here able to help me out in this situation? Like, I'm trying to be as clear as I can here as this character, and like, people are just not helping me. So,
and one of the things I think that feeling is so strong for the reason of that BJ already mentioned, but also, you know, it's worth mentioning the quote unquote real life origin of this story, that it was based on a series of these newspaper articles. Was it, help me out, BJ, was it Vietnamese children
who were having,
who were having nightmares and then dying a few days later after repeatedly telling their parents and authority figures, like, I'm scared I'm going to die, like, in my sleep, something's happening, I can't control it, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, obviously there may have been some sort of urban legendy exaggeration to these articles. It might have been, you know, some illness that was, you know, coming upon these kids.
Well, really what happens is, you know, they're having PTSD and they're not sleeping. And when you don't sleep for a certain amount of time, you do start to hallucinate things. I had to take a semester off of college because I straight up stopped sleeping. I messed up my circadian rhythm so bad that I was going like 3-4 days without sleeping. And it makes you hallucinate things. It's terrifying.
Man, I had no idea this was based on a true story or whatever, loosely based or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
It's a combination of, you know, those stories of, you know, the kids who are affected by war and having these like dream issues. But also the character of Freddy Krueger is based on somebody that Wes Craven saw as a child in Cleveland, Ohio, baby. And so the look of him is inspired by a real person. And there's, you know, the pulling these real elements into a story that is so fantastically horrifying is just wonderful. And we don't make movies like this anymore.
All the way down to the way Englund decided to play Freddy Krueger, especially in this movie, but certainly throughout the series, is he was just a little bit bitter and angry of, I don't know how old he was when he made this, probably somewhere in his 30s, late 30s or something like that. But he was angry at, you know, all these young kids coming in for the main cast and sort of, you know, envious of them. And he was like, I'm going to lean into that. You know, it's just, you know, Freddy's this guy who just hates youth. You know, he's just like, screw you guys.
Yeah, actually, I want to talk about good old Fred Krueger, as he's described in the credits of this movie. I want to talk about him in just a second. The only, the other thing that I wrote down here was the idea of like being punished for the crimes of an older generation when you had nothing to do with whatever situation they got in. And that idea is so well drawn in this movie. And I feel like we can still relate to that in many ways right now, whether it's through politics or climate change or whatever, just to name a few examples, right? So that idea I thought was really well captured. So I was curious if there were any other big fears that you both felt like this movie addressed or tapped into really effectively.
For me, kind of piggybacking off of the, you know, being punished for the crimes of a previous generation, something that always gets under my skin is how this movie deals with parents and like the teenage sort of time period you have where you are desperately trying to be seen as an individual, be seen as an adult, be taken seriously, and yet you are also at the age where you are realizing more clearly than ever that your parents are not going to be able to save you, that they are fallible, and yet you are still under their thumb. Like, Nancy is hyper aware that her dad is kind of a useless cop and that her mom is a lush, and she still can't do anything about it. So you are facing those horrors dead on, and you are absolutely powerless with how to get out from underneath it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about the reveal from Nancy's mom that she was part of this vigilante group responsible for killing our old pal Fred. So the timeline is a little confusing for me here. I believe she says that Freddie was convicted of killing something like 6 neighborhood children, which is a lot of kids, by the way. And after someone didn't fill out the right form or something like that, he was released, which is a nice little sort of drive-by indictment of the bureaucratic nightmare of our legal system. So she and some other parents got together and basically took things into their own hands after Freddie is let free. And evidently this happened at some point when Nancy was alive, because she says,
I think the implication is that, yeah, like she was a baby, you know, or
yeah,
just born,
yeah.
Or something
she says
like that.
She's like, yeah, a toddler. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Mom, when did this happen? Definitely would have been in my top 3 questions if I were Nancy in that situation hearing that story, but she does not seem to care about that at all. So I was wondering if either of you knew through the lore of other movies or anything like that, did they ever get more clear about the timeline or exactly when any of the stuff happened?
I mean, Tobe Hooper directed the pilot episode of Freddy's Nightmares, No More Mr. Nice Guy, which, you know, delves into like a, here's the real story behind the true story of Freddy Krueger. You know, Freddy's Dead, the final nightmare, has a flashback sequences to pre-burned Freddy and how he got involved with dream demon sperm things, which, you know, let's not get into that yet. there's, yes. Yeah, so to answer your question in a short way, yes, there's a lot of, you know, additions to the lore in obviously further sequels and spinoffs and whatnot. But one of the things I wanted to bring up a second ago, which this kind of lets me backdoor into, is I think just taking just this movie and not any of the sequels or spinoffs, what engages me so much about it is its structure and the way that it is essentially one long dream. Therefore, you could interpret this movie by itself, not with the sequels, as in the same way that you could interpret David Lynch's Eraserhead, which is that we're not even sure anything that we're seeing is real. In the sense that somebody else completely divorced from any of these characters could wake up and go, wow, I just had the weirdest dream. Because is there a Nancy? Is there a Fred? Is there a family? What kind of logic gaps are happening in this lore story of, mom, when did this happen? You know? So I think that's one of the most compelling aspects of this movie to me still to this day, is this unseating of reality. And, you know, this rubber reality essentially is the term that, you know, this movie acts as a flashpoint to that so many movies subsequent to this wanted to piggyback onto.
Huh, I never thought about this whole thing as like a dream sequence. I thought it did a really good job of sort of blurring the lines of when you were in a character's dream or...
oh, yeah, yeah, it's so just mercurial. It's just like you're in and you're out, yeah. And so, yeah, therefore, when are you out?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point.
There's also little things kind of scattered throughout that don't fully make sense. Like there might be something in the background on a shelf that definitely should not be there. So this movie operates really well within its dream logic. As far as, you know, Freddy lore is concerned in this movie, the thing that I always fixate on is the fact that mom took the Freddy claw with her. Like a trophy. And that is serial killer shit. Why do you have that?
Yeah.
So it's weird. I mean, yeah.
That moment is, for me, Craven really underlining this whole idea of the sins of the parents, you know, this idea.
Oh, 100%.
That, like, they're literally bringing their, you know, awfulness or their baggage into your home, in your basement, where you least expect it to be, but it's all there, you know?
It's also so fascinating that no other adult in the movie mentions anything about the murder of Freddy Krueger. Like, not even her sheriff husband in a moment of quiet between the two characters when nobody else is around. So at a certain point, I was almost like, wait, did she make this up? Because no other person, no other authority figure in the movie is even acknowledging this, that this ever happened. You would think the cop would say, I don't know, like, I feel like Nancy says to him a couple times, like, Freddy Krueger is the one who's doing this. And he just has like a blank face. There's no recognition, really. There's one moment, I think, when Freddy is first mentioned that he kind of like clocks the mom, like the two of them share like a really quick glance. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing. It's super subtle, really easy to miss. but they never have a conversation about it at all. And I'm just like, man, this is, I was kind of, part of me was bothered by that because I feel like these characters would at least like pull each other aside and be like, oh my God, do you think talk about the consequences of their actions basically. But then I was thinking about the way that Nancy's mom is portrayed in this movie as this woman who's just constantly drinking herself into a stupor. And it's like, oh, well now it's very obvious why she's doing that, because that incident had to completely scar her and alter her chemistry as a person. You know, that's wild.
Oh, totally. The theory that I've always kind of ran with is that, you know, she always says like, you know, Nancy was his favorite kind of thing. I think that she did the death blow. She's the one who killed Freddy and killed him first and then, you know, burned the house down to kind of cover up the tracks of what's going on. But like, she killed that man, like cold-blooded, yeah, killed that man.
That way.
And also, I think it's also a really good reflection of the sort of like Reagan era parenting of like, none of them talk to their kids about their feelings or about like what they were going through. Like that just wasn't a thing. We were going back to acting like it was the 50s again, and you were not to question your parents. So there, the layers of commentary that Wes Craven is dealing with here is just beautiful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not only is all that under the surface, but there's also just a very functional horror trope of, you know, treating your villain or villains, but in this case, villain, as something so unimaginably awful or evil that you don't dare not speak its name. I mean, literally, stupid J.K. Rowling did that with He Who Should Not Be Named later on. But like that goes all the way back to Dracula and the villagers in Transylvania being like, oh, no, we don't talk about the guy that lives in the castle. You know, don't go up there and don't talk about it. You know, and that idea of like sweep it under the rug as much as possible and maybe it won't come to get us.
I mean, we don't talk about Bruno, so.
Well, circling back to that idea of not knowing what elements of this movie are actually a dream or not, I was wondering what you all made of the ending of this movie. And again, it might be difficult to try to isolate your experiences of just watching this film, knowing, you know, all the stuff that happens later in this franchise. But the way that the movie ends, where like these characters basically get into what I jokingly refer to as like the Freddy Mobile and drive away, and like the mom is dead, and that character seemed to have been resurrected only to die again. And there's all these other characters who had died who seem to be alive. And like, it's clear the whole last, whatever, couple minutes of the movie is a big dream sequence again. But I was like, huh, that's it. Like, that's kind of, it reminded me a little bit of The Shining, honestly, where like, it kind of made me question everything that I saw. And like, okay, so where exactly did the story, the quote unquote real story stop and the dream begin? And I was wondering what you all made of the ending of this movie specifically, if you had any thoughts about how it kind of ends on that unsettling, ambiguous note like that.
That's Robert Shea's doing. He pushed really hard for this sort of like, was it actually a dream? Is she still dreaming? We don't know. Like, that was an ending that he pushed for pretty heavily. And so,
and he was an executive at New Line, is that right?
Yeah, Bob. Let me actually look up the proper what his role was at the time.
Well, I believe that while you're looking for that, I believe that Craven always wanted an elliptical ending of like, you know, we're not sure, but Shea was pushing for like, no, we got to have Freddy come back in some capacity. Hence the, I thought that Craven's gimme was, you know, the hand through the window, grabbing the mom and pulling her through was the, okay, I'll give that to you, Bob, you know, in terms of like, here's your final scare. But like, I remember one of the alternate endings on the multiple materials over the years of the extras was an ending that's similar, but like it's just the kids jump roping. And it's this idea of like, oh, is this gone? Is this not? It was a lot more subtle, you know, as opposed to like what we ended up with, which is very much like, oh, I guess he's not gone.
Yeah. And yeah, so I looked it up. He was the executive producer at the time. And this was one of his like big early hits in his career. But I think that's why it feels a little disjointed, because it tonally is a little different. I've sort of always just kind of like waved my hand and been like, well, it was the 80s. Everything had one of these last final jump scares that are kind of ambiguous.
It's all the children of Brian De Palma's Carrie with the chair jumper is what they
exactly
call it, in terms of like, you know, oh, we need a chair jumper at the end of our horror movie. It, you know,
yeah, That's great. So yeah, BJ, you mentioned like that it was wild that I'd never seen this before. There was a lot about this movie that I had already absorbed from pop culture osmosis, but I was delighted several times when watching this at like little details that managed to slip through the cracks for me where I didn't know what was coming. And I think I laughed the hardest at the moment when Nancy pulls the phone line out of the wall, but the phone rings anyway, and Freddie's on the other end of the phone and he's like, "I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy," and she looks down and the bottom part of the phone is turned into his mouth with his tongue sticking out of it. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my god, what an incredible image. It's so like gross and weird and specific. So I was just curious if you guys had any, I guess, indelible moments from this movie that still stick with you even though you've seen all the other movies in the franchise.
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, the two big ones for me, like, one, I love that Nancy is a mouthy broad. Like, mouthy broads are my favorite characters in movies, and she is such a good one, because I think a lot of times final girls are a little passive, and she is not passive at all. She is a willing participant who was into survival. I love her so much. But the two that will always get me is, I like to call them the marshmallow fluff stairs. There's something about yes. those stairs turning those into great. Goo that just viscerally upsets me. And it was, I think, definitely the first time I had ever seen something like that happen. I'm like, I don't like this. I mean, this is also, we were all the era of cartoons telling us quicksand was gonna get us. I don't want stairs doing that. But it will always be the bathtub, which hilariously is a shot that Wes Craven used in Deadly Blessing. And then that movie didn't do as well. And he went, screw it, I'm doing it again. And you're going to deal with it.
Yeah. You showed me this on Slack recently that the original movie. Yeah. It's a snake. And I was like, oh my god, this is like, I struggle to remember or think of another example where a filmmaker recycled imagery in quite that specific a way. A lot of times people have like visual motifs that they come back to.
There is another example I can think of, the coat hanger gag from 1941 that Spielberg cut ends up in Raiders of the Lost Ark that Tote does in the tent with Marion and Belloc.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I've never seen 1941. Yeah. So that's like one of the few Spielberg movies.
Well, it was cut from 1941. Yet. So you would have to look at the materials, but yeah. So there's definitely a couple instances that, you know, we can cite of like, you know, filmmakers being like, you know what, screw it, I'm going to try this again.
So, yeah. That image.
It's funny.
It just get, well, cause the funny thing too, is that in Deadly Blessing, it's a dick joke. Like, that's the point of it. So then when you have it in Nightmare, it's like genuinely like viscerally terrifying. I think the way I explained it to people is I was like, it's a lot like how when Jim Steinman wrote, "It's All Coming Back to Me" for Pandora's Box, an amazing song. It didn't do well. And then he went, well, it's been 15 years. Celine Dion, you want to give this a go? And then it became one of the biggest songs in the world. That's what Wes Craven's doing here with this. But yeah, there is something about that image that like shakes me to my core, because there's something so vulnerable about being in a bathtub. There are so many ways for you to die in that situation, and it's so invasive, not only just to have like someone else's hand that close to your body without your consent, but the fact that it's also razor blades, like that's just, it's too much for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of Get Out, like the god, what do they call it in Get Out, the
sunken place.
Yes, thank you. The sunken place, yes. Where there's like a whole nother universe down there, or like mm-hmm. Night Swim, I guess, more recently. Maybe be a more one-to-one kind of example there. But yeah, real quick side note on Freddy's glove. I was talking about this like with my wife when we watched this movie, and I never thought about it before because the imagery is so strong of that character with this weapon. It's so specific to him. But in the movie, as he's wielding this glove, I was kind of like, huh, this might not actually be the most practical weapon to use, because you lose a lot of the force, a lot of the power when you have individual knives on individual fingers. You know, it's much more effective if you're trying to be a killer and like actually inflict pain on somebody
Craven liked to say that part of his inspiration was, you know, he wanted to get very psychological and primal with it. So like, it's a claw of a, you know, saber-toothed tiger or lion or whatever, you know, in our collective race memory of, you know, predators, you know, and that sort of idea. And really, I mean, the glove is just like one of the iconic opening credit sequences, him building it, you know. And so it's this idea that like he's building it to just do harm. It's not even, like you say, it's not even very practical. It's not, you know, it's not efficient. The murder isn't quite the point. It's the maiming, the harm that he's going to do, you know?
Yeah, the toying with people.
I do have like a side tangent that is like a little NSFW, but it's so funny and I have to share it because I don't know when I'm ever going to get the chance to. Of course, because this movie is classic, there are many, many adult film parodies of it. But there is one specifically called A Wet Dream on Elm Street. Incredible name, no notes. But they build a Freddy glove and they swap the blades for, you know, penetrative sex objects. And it is when you realize just how impractical Freddy's glove is when it's trying to be used for something like that, because it's someone trying to be sexy with a hand full of, you know, penetratives. And it's clearly so heavy and so cumbersome. So it's someone being sexy and you just hear this thing being like clunk, clunk, clunk all over a table. And you're like, yeah, if that was actually blades, we'd be having problems. Like, there's no good coming out of this. You're not actually getting hits in.
Yeah.
Well, there's such a, I mean, obviously Craven, you know, raised strict Baptist, has this deep religious upbringing and, you know, background. The fact that he throws in a line like, this is God, when referring to the glove, you know, it's just there to be profane. You know, it is just there to just throw it in your face of like, this guy does not care about, it's not the bodies that matter, really. It's what he can do to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I want to end by talking a little bit more about Fred Krueger. And I was wondering if this was considered to be one of the more grounded, scary Freddy performances of the franchise, because I know that there's this big debate in A Nightmare on Elm Street fandom about what kind of Freddy is the best Freddy, the one who's more comedic or the one who is, I guess, a little bit more serious. So how would you guys categorize how we see Freddy Krueger in this movie, and then what type of Freddy do you each prefer? So I guess, Bill, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I definitely think he's foul in this. I mean, it's not a comedic performance in my eyes, in terms of like, there's a bit of, you know, dark humor and grand guignol in terms of not just the way that he acts and you know, the slicing off his fingers bit. And also, of course, the bed kill is so over the top that it's like, you know, a little bit funny of like, oh God, you know, that sort of idea. But I think ultimately Craven keeps a tone to it that even if it gets into dark humor territory, it's never going into cartoonish territory, which obviously some of the sequels did. And those are fine. I mean, those are fun in their own way. And it's understandable why the bar was heightened to that degree later on. But I do think that if you're asking me which one I prefer, I guess I do tend to prefer the more serious one, and not from any sort of po-faced like, oh, serious is better, fun isn't fun. I have fun. I have fun with the rest. It's really a great thing to have that variety in a franchise, you know? And I think that it made Freddy as a horror icon or slasher character his own unique thing, because it wasn't just about, oh, this one has a different mask in terms of a Jason versus Michael idea. You know, this is somebody who has its own character, his own personality in such a more distinctive, very easy to pinpoint way. But yeah, I think that there's a threateningness to Freddy in this one, as well as in 2, and as well as in New Nightmare, that the other sequels don't quite capture.
Okay. What do you think, BJ?
So I am somebody who operates under the opinion that Freddy Krueger is a drag performance for Robert Englund, the same way that Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, is a drag performance for Cassandra Peterson. And I think that the Freddy that we see in this movie versus the Freddy that we see in the more, you know, comedic movies is the exact same character. The difference is the power dynamic. This movie is when we're seeing Freddy kind of reemerge for the first time after, you know, being, I don't know, hibernating, whatever we want to call it, for many, many years. So he's coming out and he's going to be a little bit more aggressive. He's going to be darker. He's going to be a little bit more serious because he has to be. The longer the franchise goes on, the more powerful he becomes, because he's just wiping people out left and right. He doesn't have to take things so seriously. Now he can have a little bit more fun with it. So I think like those teeny tiny bits of dark humor that we're seeing in this first movie, they just get amplified later down the line because he's allowed to, because he's starting to, it's like when people start to feel invincible and they start getting a little sloppier. That's what Freddy's kind of doing in these later films. So I view the character as the same through line. It's just his behavior changes based on how powerful he's feeling. And part of why A New Nightmare gets serious again is because we're now bringing back in like Nancy, like the true foe that he has.
That's a really good point. The distinction, maybe now that I'm hearing your take on it, is maybe not about serious versus non-serious or serious versus comedic. It might be anger. in terms of, like, I think the ones that I cited and the ones that you just cited, there's a difference of the power dynamic, like you said. And in this one, and certainly New Nightmare, it's Freddy is, like, you know, a little behind the eight ball, and he's pissed. You know, it's that sort of scariness of, like, oh, okay, there's no time for jokes, because it's still the same character, as you say. If there were time for jokes, he would absolutely be making so much, many, many more jokes. But right now, he's mad. He's on a mission. Like, he's got to get this done, sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I have always admired about Robert Englund, because the thing people, I feel like everybody in here knows, but if people listening don't know, like, Robert Englund, like, has done Shakespeare. Like, he's a classically trained actor who then got pushed into a lot of character roles when he was younger, and then has pretty much stayed in the genre since Nightmare, because that's, you know, everybody knows him as Freddy Krueger, and a lot of people are incapable of separating him from, you know, the work that he puts out. But you can see that in his performance as Freddy Krueger. Like, you can see the classic talent in there, in the way that he is able to, like, switch on a dime what, you know, this scene calls for from Freddy. And, you know, I am not somebody who believes in, like, praising sacred cows. I do think that someday there should be a remake. We should get a new Freddy. As much as I love Jackie Earle Haley, it was not that. But in order for someone to pull off what Robert Englund has been able to do, they have to be able to present Freddy as layered. He has to be able to be so scary one second and cracking a one-liner the next minute. And if you can't do that, then you shouldn't be going for it. Like, I think a comedic actor is who would need to play Freddy Krueger.
Oh, totally.
Okay, so last question before we go to BJ's interview. I was looking into the franchise just on Wikipedia, trying to get a sense of how many movies there are in this thing and all that. I remember seeing Freddy versus Jason in high school, I think, and that was the only one of these movies that I'd ever seen before.
So you saw Freddy versus Jason before you ever saw the original? Wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. And that was, I mean, not a great movie in my memory, and I've not revisited it since 2003. So it's not like it left a big imprint on me or anything. But and like I said, through cultural osmosis, kind of knew a little bit about Freddy and the different versions of the character or whatever. But I was wondering about New Nightmare, because I was reading about that one and it sounds really interesting. I wonder if somebody who, like me, who's just seen this first film can jump straight into New Nightmare, because it seems like, you know, it's this very meta thing where it's about the actual actors and all of that as characters in this movie. And so I was wondering what you all thought about.
Okay, I have a huge take on this. I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
I will say that one of the things that has made the franchise one of my favorites is because it is such an enjoyable arc to watch over the movies in terms of how the character evolves, how the rules of the dream world evolve, how the lore evolves. And I think part of the meta-ness of New Nightmare and how great it is and how satisfying it is to me is coming after all of those other sequels, because in a very big way, Craven was responding to the rest of the franchise. And, you know, in terms of how the whole perception of the character and the franchise changed over 10 years, which isn't that long, you know? So I think that although you certainly can jump into New Nightmare from this one in terms of understanding, you know, what it's about and everything like that, you don't have to have like a primer on it, but like, I think the effect that it'll have will be even more, you know, doubled or tripled, you know, in the way that it was for me.
Okay. Gotcha. BJ, what do you think?
Yeah, I really love New Nightmare. I mean, I think that it's really fascinating. Personally, I think that there are some sequels that you should watch before diving into New Nightmare, but I think if you went straight to it, like, you'll still be able to follow what's going on. It'll just be a more enhanced experience if you've seen some of the other sequels.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this portion of the show. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and present BJ's interview with Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp.
So of all of the slasher and final girl combinations that exist, there's something so special about Freddy Krueger and Nancy Thompson that is just crucial to the franchise's growth and the original film's decade-spanning legacy. But instead of asking you about yourselves, I would love for you to each explain what it is about the other that makes it so important. So Heather, what is it about Freddy Krueger that makes him such a great slasher? And Robert, I'd love to hear why Nancy Thompson is such a great final girl.
All right, I'll start. So Freddy is such a great slasher because he occupies our dreams, yet every detail of his existence, his walk, his talk, his costume, everything is actually purely frightening, and it just reinforces all the work that Robert did to make that a memorable character. But what he didn't realize is that the seriousness that he approached the character really transcends, you know, I think every other horror movie monster ever. And it's, I mean, I think it's sheerly from his own effort and from the amount of love, like weird word to use, but the love that he had for the acting project that was creating Freddy Krueger.
I think what makes Nancy so special is she's inhabited by Heather, and there is a kind of classic ingenue appeal in Heather's persona, which is transferred to Nancy's, which is a perfect object of our empathy. We want to root for her. We desire her on all those levels. And, you know, I think that Heather definitely picked up the baton from Sigourney Weaver and Jamie Lee Curtis and then elevated it to a more strategic and stubborn final girl. And she's, because of her beauty and because of this ingenue quality, it makes it not just easy for the women in the audience to empathize and to follow her journey through three films, but it's also makes many of the boys, and they don't look on her as a sex symbol, a victim, you know, with cleavage in a summer camp somewhere, but they look on her as a girl they might bring home to meet mom. They look on her as a strong girl. They look on her as a girl they can fantasize about, but also that is realistic to them, and that's because of that ingenue quality. And I mean that in the classic sense of theater and all films, and we have them through Hollywood history. There's a certain kind of woman that can be in that category, and we relate to them sympathetically.
Absolutely. And, you know, slashers certainly weren't new in 1984, but Nightmare on Elm Street's practical effects really upped the stakes in a way that audiences definitely weren't prepared for. And I know that this is asking you to think back all those decades ago, but I'd love to know if there was a moment for either of you in production where you had this realization of, wow, we are really making something special here.
Well, some of the first days that we got to see dailies at lunchtime, we would go in and watch, you know, just the raw footage of the day before. I just the magic of how beautiful the movie looked in and of itself was really amazing. And the scene where the Cadillac is, you know, just driving up in front of the school and the kids are jump roping. And like there's this just dreamlike magic quality of every frame. I knew that the movie was going to be incredibly beautiful, but also weird. Like every frame has something weird in it. It's not our reality. It's a little bit heightened reality of the dream landscape, of the dream world. So I was aware right away that it wasn't just like a John Hughes teenage, you know, movie about, you know, these teenagers trying to, you know, fight Freddy off.
There must have been some code between Wes Craven and the production designers, and then between the production designers and the painting crew, because it was all of a vision. You know, the colors. Sets were painted much different colors than normally. Sometimes door frames were a little smaller to force the perspective, or a little bit askew, you know, and that just kept you off balance, you know, and it aided this sort of wonderful gimmick throughout the first Nightmare films. When does the nightmare actually begin? Mm-hmm. When have we stepped from reality into the nightmare? And again, I don't know what that code was, or if it was just a happy accident that Wes and the production designers and the painters and everybody came across.
Agreed on, yeah.
But they were all on the same page. And that's difficult to do. And I remember just seeing colors and seeing distressed. Everything was distressed, mm-hmm. you know, worn out and stuff. And I remember seeing a set that was just dressed normally. Everything was nice, except there were like some really sick, twisted antique porcelain dolls on the windowsill with cracked faces that, you know, the camera would arrive at. You know, as if the night that was the beginning of a nightmare, or that was tainted by the nightmare. And I think that really served the project, along with Jacques Heitken's cinematography and the practical special effects that were still very much in vogue then, and were also coming up to the absolute pinnacle of their thing. And I mean, now they're amazing too, but now they're aided and abetted by CGI. But this is still the time of John Carpenter's The Thing and Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise and others that really capitalized on the, and the thing that happens now so often with CGI is it begins to look a little bit like a cartoon, just a little bit. And it's okay if it's selective, and I've seen great selective use of CGI. But sometimes over the course of 90 minutes or so, when you're relying too much on the CGI, you're not as engaged because it's not as real. Mm-hmm. It's not real. And even if it's an effect that's not supposed to be real, but it's a real effect, is different than if it's just animation or CGI.
Yeah, definitely. And I have time for just one last question. So if given the chance to work together again, would you return to Nancy and Freddy, or would you make good on the line from Nightmare, finally act in a romantic comedy with a few murders?
Well, we're doing the Real Housewives of Springwood.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, no.
Or The Bachelor. I don't know. Maybe one of those.
I mean, Heather.
He would Heather's, be a great bachelor.
Heather's done comedy. She had a comedy series, a hit comedy series. And I've done comedy, but it's so strange. Even now in my career, you know, I have to remind people, you guys, you know, I was nominated for an Emmy for doing comedy years ago, you know. And it's like people forget that. They want you to be one thing. And I've been many things. I've been a.
But he's been Freddy for a long time.
A Southerner. No, a Southerner. I was a nerd. Let me tell you, it's better being a genre horror B movie star than it is being a nerd. I've been both.
Incredible. Well, thank you both so much for chatting with me. And thank you for the work that you've been giving us for the last 40 years, not just with Nightmare, but everything else. I mean, I'm a big fan of your Nancy Kerrigan, and I'm a huge fan of you in the Paper Brigade. So I'm very aware of both of your former work, but thank you.
Oh, you're very sweet. Thank you so much
for chatting.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about A Nightmare on Elm Street and all of its sequels at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a few things in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about this show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.